Are you ready to dive deep into the intersections of technology, law, and business? Catch the Tech Intersect podcast on our new Advantage Evans YouTube channel. Whether you're connecting on the go or binging episodes from the comfort of your home, you'll never miss a moment again. Plus, you'll experience all types of exciting shorts, special events content, breaking news lives, and the comprehensive learning series. Subscribe today, hit the bell for notifications, and enjoy podcast videos and more. Use the link or search for Advantage Evans on YouTube to find our channel so you can watch, learn, and engage where insider meets impact. See you there.
All of these coins are centralized. They have a central controller. They have somebody that issued it or created it that has the option of changing things. That's why they're very different than Bitcoin. Bitcoin is unique in the sense that there's no central committee. It's just anyone can put in a pull request or try a soft fork or whatever, but ultimately it's up to the individual to accept it. Whereas all of these other ones, when they change the rules, they could do it unilaterally and everyone has to follow them. That's the real difference between the two.
Welcome to Tech Intersect. I'm your host, Tanya Evans, and my life and work exist at the heart of law, business, and technology. Yeah, I've earned a few fancy titles and degrees over the years, but the bottom line is I'm a writer, speaker, teacher, and lifelong learner. And I'm really excited that you've joined me on this journey. So what is Tech Intersect? Well, it's authentic, empowering conversations with really interesting guests who demystify complex topics to prepare you for the future, because your future is now. And it exists where law, business, and tech intersect. Get ready to listen, learn, and leverage. Let's get started. Hey, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of the Tech Intersect podcast. We continue our series for Digital Money Demystified on the ramp up to the release of my book, October 24th. So tell 100 of your closest friends, join me in the virtual launch party. More details in the show notes. But today we're diving into a really pervasive myth that I think is almost the tie that binds all of the other myths together. And it's somehow that all cryptocurrencies or cryptographically secure digital assets are created equally. To help us shatter this delusion, I don't know, we'll see, and definitely to shed light on Bitcoin's undeniable dominance over fiat and other crypto assets, I am thrilled, beyond thrilled, having a fangirl moment, but I'm trying to like be cool because Jimmy Song is on, but to have Jimmy Song on with over 20 years of programming experience, numerous influential works to his credit, including his latest book, Fiat Ruins Everything, clown nose and all. We'll get to that in a moment. But Jimmy isn't just a Bitcoin OG, because that's clear, but also really a well-respected educator, a developer, entrepreneur, and his insights and perspective have really enriched my classroom and also the classrooms of University of Texas, courtrooms as an expert witness, countless readers, etc., especially also his newsletter, Bitcoin Tech Talk, and his podcast, Bitcoin Fixes This. So I can't wait to get my hands on the physical copy. And we will talk about all of that and more in a moment. But first, Jimmy Song, welcome.
Well, thanks for the lovely introduction, Tanya, as always. You really know how to stroke the egos of your guests, for sure. I'm like, who is this person that you're talking about? Sounds like somebody I want to go meet. Yeah.
It's you, man. Awesome. All right. Well, for those who don't know who you are, I want to start where we are today, and then we'll take a little journey back to circa January of 2009 and tell people what is really going on in the Bitcoin space in particular. But kick us off by explaining the inspiration behind your latest book, Fiat Ruins Everything.
This book was something that came out of a writing course I actually took online. The guy that runs that course is David Perel. He actually wrote the foreword for this book. A lot of people know about it. It's called Rite of Passage. And I took the course. I'm friends with him. I've been friends with him for several years. And I was like, finally, you know what? I'm going to go take this course. So he inspired a lot of writing in me. And I felt after the course, like I could just go write a couple thousand words on almost anything. As a result of the course, I ended up writing a regular column for Bitcoin Magazine about the various ways in which fiat money ruins things. And I got that inspiration from doing my own podcast, Bitcoin Fixes This, realized that most of it is actually fiat ruins everything. It's just, you know, Bitcoin is putting it back into the normal order. So, you know, I took some of those articles. I added a lot of other articles that I wanted to write. And I wanted to give people a perspective on just how abnormal things really are, because we tend to just be very familiar with our day-to-day and not realize just how odd the current situation is from a historical perspective and how far off we've gotten from just like a thriving civilization. And instead, we're declining in many ways. And I trace the root of all of this rot to fiat.
So for those who don't know what fiat is or, you know, aren't familiar with the definition, explain, generally speaking, what fiat is and how Bitcoin is different.
Yeah, sure. So fiat is Latin for let there be. So if you're if you read the Bible in the Latin Vulgate, Genesis 1:3 is fiat lux, let there be light. This is God's commandment to say, let there be light, and then there was light. So fiat really means let there be. And in English, it's been sort of co-opted as a way of saying, let there be something. And when we say fiat money, it literally means let there be money. And that's how the central bank and, you know, other central banks, not just the central bank of the United States, but all central banks, this is how money comes into the existence. It's by decree. It's by saying so. This is a very centralized system, obviously, because there's somebody that gets to say, let there be money. And then either actual dollar bills are printed or more likely the balance on a ledger goes up automatically. So that's what fiat money is. And it's the money that we all use, dollars, euros, yen and naira and all these different currencies, all fiat currencies. They're not backed by anything. It's not, you know, physical commodity or anything tangible. It's just something that somebody made up, basically. Bitcoin is very different in the sense that it is decentralized. So there's no single creator. There's no authority that gets to determine how much of it there is. It's actually enforced by computer code, and you can audit it by running your own node, and you know exactly how much Bitcoin there exists in the entire world. And that's not something that we have with fiat money for very obvious reasons. You know, we have like a running tally of the government deficit or something like that. And the St. Louis Fed publishes the M2 money supply and things, but it's all just sort of guesswork. We don't really know because none of this is audited. It's all just sort of speculated based on certain economic indicators and so on. So they're very vastly different systems. One is centralized, one is decentralized. And I liken Bitcoin to a digital gold. In order to get gold, you have to actually physically dig it up from the ground. And that's very, you know, painful. It costs a lot of money. It requires a lot of equipment. It requires a lot of chemicals and things like that. And similarly with Bitcoin, you can also mine it. It's just instead of digging for physical things, you're digging for mathematical things and you're looking for a particular number that satisfies a particular equation. And the only real way to do it is to brute force it. And that's what the whole mining thing is. It's just done in the metaphysical realm instead of the physical realm like gold.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
It reminds me of, first of all, I love that description. So many times people get caught up in the jargon and can't find a pathway in to start to connect the dots and connect the synapses firing. It's just, it seems foreign for so many. And I had my own you know, head against the wall experience and not fully understanding back in 2017 is when I first became aware of Bitcoin. But I think at the time I was talking more about distributed ledgers. I was getting a lot of questions about, especially with the token boom in the Ethereum realm and people starting to explore decentralized applications and building DAOs, et cetera, how to build on top of open source software. And as an intellectual property lawyer, that took me down my own rabbit hole. I quickly realized in order to fundamentally understand why the system exists, you have to understand the use case that brought it to light in such a fascinating way. But it makes me think that once you have Bitcoin and you have the alts, there's this misconception for those who are interested in the space that all cryptocurrencies are the same. So as you were beginning to describe Bitcoin, how it functions, how it is distinguished from fiat, say something also about, obviously we can't go through all the 30,000 plus and the NFTs and the ABCs, but I think you have the original use case for this type of system, and then you have everything else. As a former chair of the Maker Foundation, and now I'm on the board of DCG, although I focus very much on Bitcoin, I've never been confused about the role of Bitcoin. I have used some of my time to explore other issues and things that come up in the IP space, but fundamentally, Bitcoin is different. It's special. And so could you talk about that? Because there's such a misconception out there.
Yeah, so I actually spend a decent chunk of the book, part six, several chapters on the distinction between Bitcoin and altcoins. Bitcoin is different because it's decentralized. Like I said, anyone can audit it. It doesn't change and so on. Altcoins are very different. And one that you brought up, which is the second most popular coin at the moment, is Ethereum. And I can tell you exactly how it's different because there was a token sale, there was a pre-mine, there was something like 70% of the entire supply of Ethereum was actually sold to investors and so on. So who got that money? Well, that money went to the Ethereum Foundation, and they're the ones that, you know, sort of move Ethereum forward, and they publish roadmaps, and they're in the process of moving, for example, to Ethereum 2.0 and things like that. And if that sounds centralized, that's because it is. It's very much a centralized system, and it doesn't have this quality of decentralization, which means that there's no one in authority. So the most obvious way in which we saw that Ethereum was centralized, and prior to this incident, their tagline was code is law. And you being somebody in law, I'm sure you appreciate that. The idea was whatever smart contract you write, as it gets executed, that would be law. And, you know, we're not going to change anything. It's going to be like that. Except there was about 1/6 of the entire supply of Ethereum in a contract called the DAO back in 2016.
Yes.
And it turned out that there were some flaws in this contract. There was somebody that figured out how to drain it of all of its money. And Vitalik was basically faced this decision. Is code actually law? It's kind of like a clause in a contract that you forgot about that lets you get all of whatever, right? Like, is very favorable towards your opponent. You know, smart contracts are very similar in the sense that, okay, oh, whoops, we forgot about this clause, or we forgot that there was a way to drain it. And drain it they did. And they had to make a decision. And Vitalik ended up rolling those transactions back. And if that sounds like a centralized intervention, that's because that's exactly what it was. And they've done many more things like that since then. We talk about fiat money and the role of the Federal Reserve in the economy. They change interest rates as a way to monitor and control the money supply, right? The lower the interest rate, more money is being printed. The higher the interest rate, the money contracts a little bit, as it's happening now. Ethereum does something very similar. They changed their monetary policy something like 15 times, just sort of managing the expectations and things like that. And not only that, they have different narratives that they go into a boardroom, the Ethereum Foundation, and say, all right, what's the next narrative that's going to take Ethereum to the next level in price? And they sit in the boardroom, think about it, and say, all right, you know what? what the next one's going to be, it's going to be ICOs. Or, you know what the next one's going to be, it's going to be IEOs. No, it's going to be DeFi. It's going to be NFTs. It's going to be Web3. It's going to be Metaverse or whatever. This is a very centralized thing. And because of Ethereum's success in sort of marketing and doing a lot of this centrally as a way to gain interest, a lot of other chains have more or less followed suit, including pretty much everything in the top 10. Now, Dogecoin is a little bit of an exception, but that's something that we can go into later. All of these coins are centralized. They have a central control. They have somebody that issued it or created it that has basically the option of changing things the way they want to change, of changing the monetary policy, for example. That's why they're very different than Bitcoin. Bitcoin is unique in the sense that there's no central committee. It's just anyone can put in a pull request or try a soft fork or whatever, but ultimately it's up to the individual to accept it. Whereas all of these other ones, like Ethereum, for example, when they do a hard fork, when they change the rules and say we're gonna go to Ethereum 2.2 or 2.0, or we're going to change to proof of stake, or we're going to eliminate a lot of these fees for miners, they could do it unilaterally, and everyone has to follow them, or they're no longer on Ethereum. That's the real difference between the two. Bitcoin is decentralized and all of this other stuff is really kind of like fiat 3.0 in the sense that they are centralized.
And Bitcoin started out that way, right? I think to your point, and to close the loop on that from the beginning, this is how it ran. You know, the argument that we see between the SEC and the CFTC and every other regulatory body focuses on the nature of programmable assets and how it can transition over time. So if the argument was ETH, for example, you described the token sale, et cetera, how certain folks were enriched before others could participate, which mimics in some capacity the existing system. Over time, the argument has become this quote unquote idea around full decentralization. We don't actually have a great definition for it. And I think that definition is programmable as well, which becomes part of the problem of arguing with people over decentralization, right? But, you know, the point is really important for people to understand how something began from the beginning. And that actually makes me think of one other thing that I wanted to ask you, because you brought up the computational power that is required. And that usually leads someone to ask me, and it's one of the myths that I push back on in my book, about all of crypto being inherently bad for the environment. Without, one, comparing apples to apples, oftentimes I see people using statistics for a country and the use of electricity for a country or power versus, you know, a system that is global. I think you're never making a fair comparison. And also to appreciate, one, the impact on the environment of the existing traditional financial system. And two, the reason that the computational power is necessary, and you're going to have all sorts of risks and benefits and rewards, but the reward for the use of energy in this way actually provides security for the system. Can you bridge that divide between the reason for proof of work protocols and the role that energy expenditure plays here?
Yeah. So proof of work is basically that digital mining, if you will, like finding that nugget and saying, okay, well, this actually fits the equation and therefore it's valid. And anyone can verify it very easily. I could verify it on my phone. Whereas the amount of hashing power necessary to get that is a tremendous amount, obviously, and requires a significant use of energy. And as you alluded to, there's a security component because the energy expended is actually the exact amount of energy that somebody that's attacking the network would need to use to roll that back. The ability to not roll it back depends on this energy expenditure. So it gives these transactions a large degree of finality based on the amount of energy that's used. But more importantly, I think, you know, a lot of people think they understand money, for example, before coming into Bitcoin. And then once you discover how the Federal Reserve works and central banking works and banking in general works and how fractional reserve lending works, you realize very quickly, wow, I had no idea that that's how money works.
It's literally terrifying.
Yeah, it's very similar with energy. Most people sort of think, okay, one watt here is the same as 1 watt here and so on. And it is nothing like that. If you live near a hydroelectric dam, your energy costs are significantly less than if you are in the middle of nowhere. There are no easy sources of energy, so they have to transmit the energy very far to you and so on. This is something that not a lot of people understand, is that there is a large source of stranded energy all over the place. Not a lot of people like to be living near hydroelectric dams because if the dam breaks, then your house is gone. So not a lot of people like to live near, you know, a wind farm or a solar panel farm or anything like that, because those are windy and sunny places and you're surrounded by a lot of that stuff and you don't want to be near it.
Unsightly. Right.
So there's a lot of factors that go into energy prices, and they're not fungible. Unlike Bitcoin, a terawatt over here is not the same as a terawatt over there and so on. That's a very important thing to understand, is that energy is not equal. And once you understand that, then things start to make sense. There are these machines, for example, that parts of the grid have, and their purpose is literally just to use up energy. No other purpose than to use up energy. And these things cost like $25,000. And the reason why they have to have them is that the electrical grid near it needs a certain amount of load. Past a certain load, you know, it will break. So it needs to consume this energy during certain times if other people aren't using it. Otherwise, things break. These machines exist there, and a lot of power companies have them. It's literally just draining energy. And you need that to have grid stabilization. Otherwise, you know, there are parts of the grid that will just go down or get overloaded and things like that. Particularly around like wind farms and stuff, it's like really windy. You know, I'm sure you've heard of like some of these things breaking because it's generating too much energy and so on. These are things that you actually need to worry about when you're managing something as complicated as energy. It's not so simple. So Bitcoin mining actually tends to go towards where it's cheapest, and it's very unique in the sense that it's portable. You can go bring miners pretty much anywhere. You just need to build a facility and you can move things around. It's being used currently where energy is cheapest, meaning that there's a lot of energy generation. For example, you get gas flaring. So in any oil drilling operation, oil never comes by itself, always comes with natural gas. And there are certain regulations by which you have to expend of that gas because it's flammable and it's very bad for the environment and so on. So, you know, what a lot of these drillers will do is they'll burn it into the atmosphere, turn methane into carbon dioxide, essentially. But you use a Bitcoin miner, no methane goes into the atmosphere. No carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere. You have the equivalent of a muffler, basically, and you can safely dispose of it and not put it into the environment. That's a win for everybody. That's not something that a lot of people understand or know about because they know so little about energy. But as you study it, it's like money. It starts making a lot more sense, the economic incentives and so on. So it's a nuanced and subtle argument, much like the argument for Bitcoin, like we were talking about. But it's something that people need to understand. This world is complicated. It's not a very straightforward, okay, you know, here are these evil people like using up our energy versus, you know, the people that want to keep things pristine. It's nothing like that. It's a very complex system. And once you understand how it works and the incentives around it, Bitcoin mining makes all the sense.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tanya M. Evans, author of Digital Money Demystified. And I want to let you know that to stay on the leading edge of any opportunity, especially investing, you have to empower yourself with the tools and resources needed to keep your knowledge and skills current. And if you're relying on last year's information or even last month's, look, you're already behind. Sure, you can try to figure this out on your own at YouTube University. The problem is, it's difficult to separate fact from fiction with so many carnival barkers banking on your inexperience. And of course, there are the naysayers, usually from legacy finance, banking on your fear while they quietly help their high net worth clients to invest. all of it muddies the waters when all you want to know is how to get in safely, legally, and confidently so you're not left behind. That's why I wrote Digital Money Demystified, where I take the top 10 crypto myths head on and give you well-researched, well-supported facts to empower you to make good choices out there in the new digital cash economy. As a law professor who developed the first blockchain crypto and law online certificate program, a retail and corporate crypto policy and education trainer, and a thought leader appearing regularly on national media, I've done the heavy lifting so you don't have to. Look, there are plenty of books and courses on which crypto assets to invest in. Digital Money Demystified is the book you read before you dive into those. So head to digitalmoneydemystified.com to learn more and prepare for the future of money and wealth today. That's one of the many things I love in my own origin story and evolution. I have learned, despite all of my education, Northwestern University and being, you know, the editor-in-chief of my law journal at Howard and my esteemed CV, I learned more in the last 6 years about finance and banking, the self-sovereignty that comes from being clear about where my assets are and how I intend to use them, the thought process that is required to actually move things that gives you a pause, right? It's not you're scanning here and tapping there and you are just falling in on one hand in the fiat system to just spend. We're not even touching money anymore, not fully appreciating the privacy issues, which is leading me up to the one of the last questions that I want to engage with you about in the world of CBDCs. Let's get there in a second. But I have learned more about finance, about community, about myself, and certainly about energy and all the other things that we've just abdicated so much of our power over to others. I'm shocked. And I see it everywhere. A lot of the pushback and the myths come from people not trusting themselves. And a lot of that lack of trust in themselves comes from a lack of education that is a feature, not a bug of the system. And so that leads me to a short discussion around central bank digital currencies. I was just in DC last week, had a meeting with counsel to the Secretary of the Treasury, Yellen, on a range of issues in the tax sector. But inevitably, central bank digital currencies come up. FedNow, not a currency, but certainly the rails that I feel would are leading up to eventually a CBDC in the next, 4 to 6 years. I don't think that's unlikely. And my grave concerns, and I know that you probably share them around financial privacy, I feel like people are not just asleep. It's that quadrant where they don't know that they don't know. Can you talk to us, because this is another way to make the distinction between from Bitcoin in particular, fiat and central bank digital currencies, which also forced me and others to learn about the layers of the banking system. Caitlin Long was on recently for that topic too. So I know that's a lot and was leading up to central bank digital currencies, but your thoughts, sir? I'm sure you have many.
First of all, we have to recognize that most fiat currencies are largely digital already. It's not something new. When you're using a credit card, that's digital. When you're using PayPal, it's digital. When you're doing almost anything other than straight cash, it's going to be digital. There's some digital component. So in that sense, the dollar system, the euro system, most systems around the world are already digital. What's different about a CBDC is that it takes out a lot of the middlemen. Right now, the way that you get access to this digital part of the dollar is through credit cards, through banking, Venmo or Apple Pay or whatever, like whatever it is that you're using, it's usually some sort of third party. What CBDCs do is centralize all of that. So instead of having a bank account at your local bank, what a CBDC allows the government to do is have each citizen have an account with the Fed, right? Like you have a direct bank account, and I'm sure it'll be sold as some sort of like financial justice or something like that. Like everyone's going to have an account, you know, like one of the indicators of wealth is having a checking and savings account or something like that. And you'll have them both. And it'll be very easy to push out like, you know, subsidies and, you know, payments of things. You'll get it and blah, blah, blah. And it'll be much easier. That's how it'll be sold. But really, the main thing that the entire structure of a CBDC lets the Fed do is it takes out all of these middlemen. Banks right now are required to do AML KYC reporting so that the government can sort of watch what's happening and, you know, certain transactions over a certain amount. Okay, what's going on? And the banks are required to do it. They're essentially deputized for the sake of surveillance. But if you have a CBDC, you don't need any of that. Because everyone has a direct...
No more deputy.
You know, you just have that one account, right? And that's your... and I'm sure the FDIC limit... I mean, there's really no FDIC necessary because it's just sort of like, we'll make good. We can put money to make that happen, right? That's sort of the end game that the government is looking for. And no doubt there are some probably within that movement that are thinking, okay, well... It'll make things efficient, it'll lower costs for a lot of people, and it'll be more just, and we can do government policy better and so on. But it is a nightmare for financial surveillance because the government will know not just the purchases or transfers over a certain amount, they'll know everything. Everything. You know, instead of cash or whatever, they can just take it away whenever it's inconvenient for them or whenever you're protesting too much or whatever. And unless you believe that that's like sort of a far off reality, this happens all the time in other parts of the world or even in the United States. So there was a Department of Justice program called Operation Choke Point many years ago. They were targeting, I believe, marijuana dispensaries mostly, but even some gun shops.
Gun shops, payday loan.
The stuff that they didn't like, they decided to just basically debank. And that is a civil liberties issue, right? That's a property issue because your property is essentially confiscatable by them at any time. And I mean, if you know the station's history, those are not good powers to be giving the government. You know, if they have the power to take it away, as soon as your political opponents are in power, they will, with sufficient sort of cover, I suppose, they'll do it. And this is where Bitcoin is just so different than CBDCs because it lets you have real property rights over your property. So instead of it being subject to the gatekeeping and permission of those in power, you just have it. And instead of getting taxed, you know, whenever they feel like you're making too much or whenever they feel like you got it illegitimately or something, they can't do it. That's the real sort of appeal of Bitcoin, is that you are sovereign over your own property, whereas the current system, it's, you know, somewhat controlled by the government, but, you know, in a CBDC world, it's completely controlled by the government. That's the dystopia that we really want to avoid.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Oh, dear. I have to pause and think on that. All right. Before I lock myself back in my bubble and go off the grid. Final question is the comparison between Bitcoin and maybe just to ask it this way. Do you think that there is a role for stable coins for the, you know, the DAI and the USDC, Tether, et cetera? What if any role plays in the future utopia that is centered around Bitcoin?
I think stable coins are something of a transitional thing. And this is largely due to the trust that a lot of people have around the dollar. And for good reason. It's been the world reserve currency since at least 1944. But the main thing about stable coins is that they're really essentially kind of bank accounts for people that don't want to do AML KYC. Now, there's another category of stable coin, and these are algorithmic stable coins. And this includes stuff like DAI, and Luna had one, for example, UST. There was there's still one with that's based on Tron and some others. I would not trust those because they are algorithmic and they depend on a certain set of conditions being there. And as soon as one of those break, you get sort of the blow up that you had with Luna or one of these other ones. And they usually try to attract you with some form of yield or something like that. The yield is never free. You're the yield, right, at a certain point. So you got to be very careful about that. But the ones that are sort of custodial, I would say, like the as in Tether or USDC, where they have a bank account somewhere, it's just basically a way to have a bank account within the bank account. So you want to save in the dollar. Well, this is the way to do it without having lots of cash, which is the alternative. And that can be a nightmare just in securing it and carrying it around and all this other stuff. So that's the role that stable coins play. And certainly in developing countries, this is very popular because their native currency is often going down much faster. So it's a way to hold on to their savings. But long term, I think eventually when we are on a Bitcoin standard, I don't see the role of stable coins necessarily being there because Bitcoin is just so much clearly superior and there's no third party that you have to trust. With Tether, you have to trust Tether, the company, USDC, I think it's Circle and many others. That lack of third party trust is the key thing that Bitcoin brings that I think people will trust much more because you don't have to trust anybody. And that makes it, interestingly enough, much more trustworthy. So that would be the main use case that I see going forward. Now, in like a world of CBDCs, I can see stable coins becoming really popular because now, like, it's not surveilled, right? Like, this is the only way to do things without the AML KYC that's inherent in every CBDC transaction. So, you know, it's possible that it could take up that role. But then if that's the case, then you can see a government saying, okay, well, if you're doing a lot of stuff that we don't like with this, we're going to shut it down, you know, in which case you might get rug pulled. So I would say Bitcoin is the main use case here. There's some role for stablecoins in between this time and hyper-Bitcoinization. But yeah, that's my perspective on it. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. So for those who are just starting their journey into the wonderful, I hate when people say wild, West, blah, 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 even with your very cool cowboy hat, we'll leave the West out of this. But for the wonderful world of Bitcoin, digital assets, what's that one piece of advice or insight that you'd leave with them from Fiat Ruins Everything?
The book itself is aimed more at people that are already in Bitcoin. So to answer your question, I would say that...
Start with my book, Digital Money Demystified, and when you get clear, then go to this one. Is that good?
Yeah. Well, that's definitely part of it. What I've noticed is that for most people to really understand Bitcoin takes a few years. So understand that this is going to be a long journey. It's not something that you're going to get in a few hours and be like, aha, all right, I understand it now. Now I can, you know, like reorder my life around it or whatever. Even very smart people, some of the smartest people, you know, in the world, it still takes them months to get. So like a few examples I could think of are Michael Saylor, Russell Kung, and Nayib Bukele. Like it still took them many months to understand what Bitcoin is, what it's for, whatever. The piece of advice I would give is don't think that you know it yet, right? Like go and really study it and understand what's going on. It's okay to be overwhelmed at the beginning. There are lots of resources now to start getting it, including your upcoming book. The thing is, it's not going to be something that you're going to get right away. It's something that you're going to need to study and put some time into. And like anything worthwhile, you're gonna have to put some effort, some time, probably some money into really understanding what it is. So I wish you luck on that journey, but that's where to begin, is to realize at the beginning that you really don't know much and that there's a road ahead, but at the end of the road are some really, really good things.
Fantastic. Great advice. You can find out more about the book at fiatruinseverything.com. Also available at bitcoinmagazine.com. Is that accurate?
Yeah. It's also on sale at Amazon.
Well, if you want it autographed, you need to go to fiatruinseverything.com. Let's, you know, keep this cycle of energy of this money and this energy of education and the future that really is in our hands. For the first time that I can remember in my lifetime, the thing that separates me from my ability to really leverage my own ingenuity, my own creativity, the energy of my own microeconomy within my family, and being intentional about it, really comes from the world of digital assets generally, and Bitcoin in particular. Since this is going to be a long road, and God willing, you'll get older anyway, start today. Start today. And a little bit over time you're going to look back on this moment and say, that was a damn good choice. And I'm glad I listened to Professor Tanya and Jimmy Song. Jimmy Song, thank you so much. I thank you so much for your work. And I look forward to continuing to nation build in this space with you. So thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Tech Intersect podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you love it, please tell the world. If not, go ahead and tell me. And in either case, drop a comment or ping me on social media at IPProfEvans with the hashtag TechIntersect. And finally, a quick reminder on digital safety. There are a lot of scammers out there impersonating me and others, and I need your help. Now hear this, and remember, I will never slide into your DMs to say peace and blessings or hey, and I will never reach out to solicit your time or your money on social media, like ever. I'm not a trader. I am an educator and an attorney licensed in 4 states. Thank you very much. I'm here to inform, inspire, and empower. No cap, and definitely no Forex. So be careful, make good choices, and remember, I developed an entire free masterclass about the topic of digital safety in the crypto space. So check out secureyourcryptobag.com for more information. That's secureyourcryptobag.com. All right, that's all for this episode. Until next time, continue to shine.